From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. We'll learn more today about the Journal Sentinel's investigative series on safety conditions at some local barrel refurbishing plants.
Later, why the food lab at Mount Mary University got a million-dollar makeover before the school year.
Well, previously, we had a food lab that had a lot of feeling like it was grandma's 1950s kitchen.
Milwaukee Magazine marks a significant anniversary for the publication.
And Robert Cohen talks about the palpable energy that comes with a terrific musical collaboration.
You're desperate, actually. I mean, I was sending the messages, we were messaging each other, you know, the day after saying, I'm already missing really playing with you, you know, because there's that sense that if that's how it can be, you just want to continue.
Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Joy Powers. For more than a decade, residents in St. Francis, Wisconsin have been complaining about smells. Sometimes putrid and often abrasive, these smells wafted over local residents from the nearby Mid-America Steel Drum plant.
The barrel refurbishing plant has been at the center of an investigative series by the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel called Burned. Since the series first started, a number of other investigations have been launched by both state and federal agencies.
Journal Sentinel reporter and assistant editor John Diedrich has been one of the driving forces behind the series. John, thank you so much for coming in today.
Thanks for having me.
Tell me about the Mid-America Steel Drum plants. What are they? What do they do?
So there are three of them in the Milwaukee area, one in St. Francis, one in Oak Creek, and one in Milwaukee. What they do is they take 55-gallon drums, these steel drums that so many of us see carrying anything from vegetable oil to chemicals, paint, things of that nature. And they take those after they've been used, and their business is refurbishing those. In other words, taking them, cleaning them out, making sure all the material's out of them, sandblasting them, bringing them down to metal, repainting them, and sending them back out. They also accept and refurbish, but for the most part recycle, plastic totes that also could carry chemicals and other materials. So that business has been going here for a long time in the Milwaukee area. Some of these plants go back more than 100 years. The history in the St. Francis plant is quite extensive. These plants have been knit together, if you will, in recent years by a new company that bought the three of them.
So how long have the complaints been going on? You said the plant, especially in St. Francis, has been there more than 100 years?
That's right. There are complaints, smell complaints, that have gone on for more than 15 years. We have protests that happened that long ago. In 2005, there was a protest in which people donned gas masks, safety masks, and so forth to try to highlight the fact that this facility smelled. There have been concerns around the Oak Creek plant, not so much the Milwaukee plant because they do not have a smokestack that emits and they don't burn anything there. So it's a little less well known to the neighborhood of what's coming out of there. But the smells have gone on for quite a while. What has increased here is the findings of the actual risk that we know now that's coming from those facilities.
When you say smell, can you describe what you mean?
Well, so the smells vary depending on what's happening in the plant. And I've spoken to residents, particularly in St. Francis, who live a lot closer to the facility than they do, say, in Oak Creek. The smells, and I've smelled them myself, though certainly not to the extent that the residents have, but they can be a paint or a solvent smell, sometimes smells like old paint, sometimes has a wire, like a burning wire smell, a burning plastic smell. There's like a paint thinner smell that will come out of there. Sometimes there's an egg smell, like a sulfury smell. So it varies. And what's difficult for the residents first of all, these smells are overpowering certain days depending on the wind and what's actually happening in the plant there in St. Francis. But the smells also can dissipate very quickly. The St. Francis city manager was out and smelled the smells the other day, and they went on for quite some time and then very suddenly disappeared. The plume coming out of the smokestack disappeared. And what that indicates from experts that we've talked to is probably some production has changed, something has changed inside the plant of what they're doing at that moment, and that's how quickly the smells can dissipate. Also, wind plays a big part in this.
So what is happening in the plant that is causing the smells and causing this disruption to the people in the area?
Our investigation began in February of 2017, and it was keying off a whistleblower who was hired actually by the company as a safety consultant. And what he saw inside the plant so concerned him that he turned into a whistleblower and started secretly recording the safety manager who worked for the company. And that manager was describing concerns that he had about safety and that the fact that it did not appear to be destined to be fixed anytime soon. So what the law states is that when these barrels and these totes come into the facility, they're supposed to be empty. And empty, as defined by that, is not every single drop or drab of something that's in the bottom, but essentially nothing can be poured out of the drum or out of the tote, the chemical plastic tote. That's not the case. The whistleblower, along with a dozen workers that we've interviewed from various facilities in the area, have told us that's not the case, that there are chemicals that come in sometimes a quarter full in the bottom, sloshing around in the bottom. Those chemicals have been mixed together, poured off and mixed together into one tote or a barrel. They also have been burned off. The residual material has been burned off, and part of that is what's accounting for the smell that goes on in these areas. And sometimes the material has been poured down the drain. So these are all violations, and ultimately regulators came in and documented those violations. But there also have been violations related to mercury, which is a heavy metal that that's shown up in the St. Francis plant. There were violations related to failure to disclose information, failure to have proper permits, and also sending material to landfills that are hazardous waste.
Now you mentioned mercury, and you said before these drums can carry a lot of different types of things. Vegetable oil, which would be, you know, really benign. But what are the more dangerous chemicals that are in these drums that are possibly getting into the air?
Well, they could be anything. So so the drums themselves come in. They could come from a plant, a paint factory, that a plant that makes paint, so they could have residual paint thinners. There are possible carcinogens that they deal with that coming out, pesticides, things of it's an industry that essentially is in the recycling business, and so anything that goes into these drums could end up coming into the facility, and including food and food grade as well. Those sometimes, depending on what the food is or the concentrate, those can present problems too. We talked to workers who were dealing with citrus smelling items that, well, you know, citrus, that smells good. Well, not in these concentrations. Very powerful smell. And that puts out a very strong smell, or a wintergreen kind of smell. And they described how that can literally sort of take your breath away as that drum is opened up. So there's a whole host of things. The problem becomes when these materials are mixed together and they are put together in a drum, they can create reactions. They can essentially start steaming or boiling, or even a fire can start. And we've seen that in the plants around the country. There was a fire in St. Francis a number of years ago. So that is a common risk inside these facilities, is reactions that come from mixing these chemicals together.
Now, a number of investigations have been launched in response to your reporting, but one of the things that I found interesting is, especially we were just talking about workers, OSHA hasn't been in two of the plants in Milwaukee, is that right?
Well, it took quite a while. They have now finally opened up investigations into those. And I should note that there also has been a big push among elected officials, particularly Senator Tammy Baldwin and also Gwen Moore, but others as well. And they have pushed hard. And OSHA has been the one that is a bit puzzling why, given the reporting and what we found and the reports, that they were so slow to go in. But they finally did open investigations into all three facilities in the Milwaukee area, and they found violations in two of them. They're still working on the third one at St. Francis. So you have multiple risks. You have risks to the workers who are, you know, sort of right there dealing with the chemicals and the exposures from those, and that's what OSHA is working on. Then you have EPA, Environmental Protection Agency, the Department of Natural Resources, and the Department of Transportation, U.S. DOT. All of them have a piece of this in terms of regulation of these types of items. And when EPA came in, one of the things they did is they sent in their inspectors to the neighborhood. So they not only wanted to see what was inside the plant, but experience what was going on or talk to the residents in the area. And what was interesting is when they came in, those two EPA investigators, they themselves got sick as they spent a week in the area around the St. Francis plant. And when I say sick, they experienced headaches, nausea, dizziness, peripheral neuropathy, which is tingling and numbness in the hands and fingers, the same kinds of health ailments that the residents are reporting. And so that, along with some other information, really heightened the urgency on the part of EPA and actually prompted them to go, EPA, to go to a federal judge and get a warrant signed by a federal judge to be able to get into the plants without notice, because as they tried to go in and do their inspections, they were stopped by the companies from going in immediately. They had to wait. And during that waiting period, what the EPA was concerned about is that they were not seeing the true operations. And in fact, they wrote in a deposition that the, in an affidavit, excuse me, that, that the operations were staged, that they weren't seeing true operations inside the plant.
Now, the DNR has a very recent update about their investigation. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, so just in the last few days, we've had reports from the DNR that indicate that they have taken their violations. They found 19 violations that they issued in July, 250 pages of enforcement documents, and they have forwarded that to the State Department of Justice for possible litigation. That's significant because while DNR has not issued fines at this point, those could be forthcoming. There also could be a lawsuit in state court against the companies forcing these changes. These violations that have been leveled by the DNR involve air and hazardous waste violations. So we'll see where that goes. This is very fresh, coming just, as I said, in the last few days. Separate from that, EPA has issued 20 violations, federal violations. They've also done air testing, and as I indicated, they haven't concluded whether the air is presenting a risk. We at the Journal Sentinel did our own air testing. We hired a company out of Chicago to come in and did air testing, actually more thorough even than the EPA. And over that week, we found we detected these volatile organic chemical levels that were high, that crossed into what constitutes a nuisance, and also the presence of a number of chemicals that the EPA said have been associated with subchronic ailments. What happens with EPA at this point remains to be seen. The case itself is being run out of Washington, and that is typical for environmental cases that possibly involve crimes or civil violations. The EPA is working with the city of St. Francis in the case of the plant there, and they are asking St. Francis to do air testing for them. St. Francis City, as I mentioned, this has been a longstanding issue. They have just recently passed a resolution asking the EPA and DNR to move as quickly as they can to conclude their investigation and possibly help them in an action to declare the plant there a public nuisance. That's a difficult task, and the city is sort of just taking that on right now. Those are difficult because the definition of what a nuisance is can be debated, but they're looking for some hard evidence from EPA and DNR to possibly make that case on their behalf.
Well, John, I look forward to reading the rest of your pieces as they come out. And thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thanks for having me.
John Diedrich is a reporter and assistant editor for the Journal Sentinel's investigative team. Their series on local barrel recycling plants is called Burned, and you can find a link from WUWM.com.
Next on the show, we'll visit the completely revamped food lab at Mount Mary University and learn how it's integrated with the wider community. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM.
Continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Joy Powers. Notre Dame Hall, the iconic building on the Mount Mary University campus, was built nearly 90 years ago. But the work that goes on in one particular room is anything but historic. It's cutting-edge work being done in a space that serves the university and the community at large.
A $1 million renovation last summer upgraded the school's food lab, the centerpiece for the only four-year food science degree offered in the Milwaukee area. The lab also serves the dietetics program at the school. Back in the fall, I had a chance to stop by the renovated space and met with Ann Vravik, who teaches in the food science department. Thanks for having us out here.
You bet. It's great to have you.
Well, and so let's start with where we are. There's lots of clinking going on around us. Tell me about the room we're sitting in.
We are sitting in the new food lab here at Mount Mary University, and this is the space where we do the dietetics teaching as well as the food science teaching.
Well, give us a thumbnail sketch. I mean, I think people have a sense for what food science is and what dietetics are, but can you kind of give us a compare and contrast? What are those two disciplines as they're taught at Mount Mary?
Yeah, well, dietetics has a focus on patient health. And so they're looking at giving the best recipes, or I shouldn't say recipes, the best food and nutrition to someone who is in a state of poor health or in health that needs some improvement or some attention. Food science, on the other hand, we're studying the whys and hows. Where does food not only come from, but why does it do the things that it does when you cook it or store it or change its texture, flavor, all of that sort of thing.
And presumably these two disciplines actually relate to each other as well. There are needs for a food scientist to understand dietetics and a dietitian to understand food science.
Yes, quite a bit. In fact, dietetics relies on food science in order to improve the health of patients. Whereas in food science, we're interested in what it is that keeps the food healthy and nutritious.
Well, so, and you teach food science here. Mm-hmm. The students that come through your program, what do they go on to do?
Well, food science is really diverse. So you could be in an area of research and development, which in and of itself is quite diverse. So you could be interested in just studying the flavors of foods and getting them correctly balanced for the best flavor possible. You could be interested in the color. You could be interested in the preservation of food. You could be interested in the health area of food. And all of those in R&D are used in order to make the best particular food product that a company would be developing. So there's R&D. There's also areas like marketing. You could be in the area of just understanding food to the point where you're developing and marketing the product for sale. You could be in even the area of writing and promotion that way. So you could be doing food blogs or writing for magazines or newspapers, that sort of a thing. And then there's the quality area, food safety. There's a lot of people that go into determining whether or not food products are safe, how they come off the line at a food processing plant if they contain microorganisms or mycotoxins or things that would alter someone's, you know, health or response to the food. So there's all different kinds of places you can go with food science.
Well, give us a before and after kind of snapshot of what the food lab was like until just a few months ago and what you're able to do here today because of what's around us.
Well, previously, we had a food lab that had a lot of feeling like it was grandma's 1950s kitchen. And it was lovely. It was perfectly stocked. It did its job. However, things were getting a little bit outdated in terms of technology. And we realized very quickly that we needed to keep up with the changing times. And if our students were going to be able to present themselves well enough in industry, sure, they had to have better technology. So we gutted this entire kitchen or this entire laboratory space. It's quite huge, as you can see.
Yeah.
And added additional lab spaces. So the cooking equipment is all up to date, and all of our lab technology is up to date as well.
So these are, I mean, brand new ovens, brand new stoves, brand new everything.
Right, exactly. Plus we added induction ovens, which is a whole new technology in cooking, which we felt that our students needed to understand. And induction cooking is an incredible new technology.
So explain induction cooking for us.
Well, induction cooking doesn't actually use the same sort of gas heating that we're used to, or even electrical heating. It does use electricity, but it creates a magnetic field. And the magnetic field then causes the pan to heat up. So it's not the stove itself that's cooking, it's the magnetism in the pan that's doing the cooking.
And so there's not an application of heat from one spot, the food is all heating up at the same rate?
It is, heating up at the same rate and then within the pan itself. So you can actually touch the cooktop and it's not hot, but the pan is hot. So that's how it works.
There is also, just on the other side of the wall to my left, something called a sensory evaluation lab, which at first blush looks like a big empty room. Talk about the significance of that and how it relates to the lab we're in right now.
Yeah, the sensory lab is actually intended to be a big empty room. We want people that come in to taste different food products to not have any interference with smells or visual cues or things that might bias your opinion about a taste. So what people are doing is coming in to taste things that the food scientists have developed. So for example, a couple of weeks ago, we were looking at different mozzarella cheeses in terms of their fat content and how the fat then plays a role in what we perceive as saltiness. So they were studying whether or not high fat makes something taste less salty or more salty. So we had students and staff on campus come into that big empty room, sit down at their little desk spaces where there's no, no extra lighting, no smells, no anything. And we would pass food in then to them from this lab space into that big empty room.
Pass-through windows in this room, yes.
Those pass-through windows. And they couldn't then smell what was going on here in our lab. That was a very clean environment from which then to really concentrate on what they were tasting and whether or not they could sense the difference in the saltiness.
And I gather even the lighting in there is set up so that that takes one more stimulus away.
Exactly. So we have either natural lighting, so there are some cases where you want people to see differences in colors. There are other times where you don't want them to see differences in colors. So we have a whole different rainbow of colors of which we can add then to their tasting experience. So for example, this cheese that they were looking at, one of the recipes turned out to be a little bit more yellow than the other, and it was a difference in just a vitamin content of the two, and we didn't want that to bias their opinion on the taste. So if you look at a yellow cheese, that doesn't always necessarily look as appetizing as a pure white cheese when you're thinking of mozzarella. So the lighting we had on a red hue, and the red color then cancels the yellow color, and you can really focus on just the flavor and not the difference in the visual aspect of it.
Talk about the demonstration kitchen that is right here, because I gather this is something else that is greatly improved since the previous food lab.
Yeah, our demonstration station is fabulous because it gives me an opportunity to demonstrate to the students exactly what I want the skills for them to learn. It also has a television screen rather than a chalkboard or a whiteboard. So I am actually not even using a chalkboard anymore in my teaching. I guess people haven't used chalkboard for forever, but with a whiteboard, I'm not drawing on anything anymore, except that I have an iPad now that I carry around, and I can actually draw on the iPad with my PowerPoints. So students are getting a much more interactive understanding of the teachings that I'm offering. So they see not only what I'm demonstrating on the station, but then I can also demonstrate it if I'm looking at a chemical equation, for example. I can write out that chemical equation on that TV screen there.
And so this large TV screen is split into multiple views, and they can see the equation. They can also
see the
three cameras showing what you're doing.
Exactly. So if I'm trying to show them something like, what a smoking oil looks like, I can actually zoom in on it and show them what they are supposed to be looking for.
Talk about the development process for this lab. How much of it was shaped by what you already knew you wanted, and how much was shaped by, you know, reaching out to industry around Milwaukee to find out what kinds of skills they're looking for in graduates?
Yeah, that's a great question. We actually have an advisory committee that we refer to for a lot of information on what industry is interested in. So our advisory committee consists of about, right now we're at about 8 different food companies in the Milwaukee area, and they are experts in the food science world, and they join us by teleconference about once a month, once every 6 weeks, and we have offered up a number of questions to them about what they expect from a food scientist, and they continually give us feedback about things like whether or not certain regulations should be taught to the students, what sort of skills they should know, even details on the classes themselves. I had quite a few questions on what I should teach in food engineering, which is a very difficult course, not only for the students to take, but also in order to just focus on the important areas in food engineering. I mean, you could go on and do an entire degree in that. So what were the important points about engineering that they needed to know in order to be effective food scientists in the real world?
Well, so, and I wondered whether having a lab like this pushes the envelope for you even.
Oh, for sure. So I have already had multiple opportunities to expand my teaching in terms of what I'm showing the students. So for example, in our engineering class, for example, we were talking about induction cooking. They had to learn the equations, the electrical currents. They had to know all the details about what really goes into induction cooking from an engineering standpoint. So we came here into the lab and we actually did a few experiments right there on the stove so they could see what we were talking about, you know, and what is that magnetism, what pans work, what don't, and why do they work, why do they not work, that sort of thing.
Ann Vravick, congratulations on the new space, and thank you so much for showing us around.
Oh, thank you, and thanks for coming.
Ann Vravick is an adjunct professor in the food science program at Mount Mary University in Milwaukee. You can see pictures of the school's new food lab at wuwm.com.
Milwaukee Magazine ticks off a big milestone on the odometer. We'll hear more when Lake Effect continues in a moment on 89.7 WUWM. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Joy Powers. This month's cover of Milwaukee Magazine has a celebratory look, the number 35 adorned with a hefty splash of color. It's the 35th anniversary of the magazine as we know it today. The January issue features some highlights from the past 3.5 decades.
It also includes interviews with a handful of the magazine's past editors-in-chief. The current one, Carol Nixon, is in the studio with us to share some of the look back. Welcome back to the show.
Oh, thank you so much. It's great to be here.
And congratulations on 35 years for
well,
the magazine.
Well, thank you. I can only take responsibility for about a year and a half, but it's certainly an honor to work at a magazine that has this kind of history behind it and this kind of future to look forward to.
Well, and that actually mentioning the fact that, you know, you have been responsible for just the last year and a half of it kind of starts where I wanted to start, because for you, this must have been a dive back through things that many of which you're learning about for the first time.
Absolutely. You know, the magazine is owned by Quad Graphics and the Quadracci family. And Betty Quadracci, of course, is a legendary figure. And, you know, I knew a lot about her before working on this issue, but through working on this issue, I came to know her even better and how I wish she were around and could advise us now and all those things. But she really, I think, gave a gift to the city when her family purchased the magazine. And I think that a city magazine is so important to the vitality of a city. Sometimes I think it's more important now than ever. One of the things that I reflected on when I was going back through all the issues is that 35 years ago, when the news cycle was shorter, a city magazine was still part of breaking news, and they did a lot more investigative pieces, and I know that from talking to previous editors, there was a sense of competition with the local paper and all of that. And, you know, all of that has changed in large part. The magazine today doesn't break news. The news cycle is so quick these days that the newspaper can barely break news, you know. So that's all different. And I think that when I think of the Journal Sentinel, I don't think of it as our competition. I think of it as I think we augment each other and support each other. So these are, you know, some of the things I've been musing about.
Well, right. I was going to ask. So what do you see, you know, when you look back, you sort of gave us the snapshot of the place of Milwaukee Magazine in the media landscape 35 years ago. When you think about where Milwaukee Magazine and other magazines in other places like it are today, what role do you think is the most important role that a magazine like yours plays?
You know, I think that over the decades, local communities are reported on less and less. We default to national news. Even with the newspaper being owned by Gannett, we lose that local flavor. I think first and foremost, when I create the lineup for each month, I think about how can I report on the things that matter to this community, the things that are truly local. And in fact, a little further into 2018, we're launching a little tagline, Read Local, because, you know, as we try to eat local and shop local, I think it's really important not only for us to put out this magazine that reports on local things, but for the community to read it, to stay involved. So when I think of the mission of the magazine 2018, that's first and foremost in my mind, just to report on what's important to the local community. But I also think that celebrating what's good about the community is the theme that runs through all these issues. And then also to inform, because there's so much great stuff going on in Milwaukee, and just providing that service of, you know, this is going on next weekend and this is going on next summer. And I think that that's crucial.
You mentioned Gannett buying the, mm-hmm. the Journal Sentinel. When you think about Milwaukee Magazine, how important is local ownership?
Oh, I think it's very important. And moreover, the support that Quad Graphics gives the magazine and the Quadracci family gives the magazine. Really, we are blessed to be in a position where they good-naturedly leave us alone and let us do our job and take the time to tell us when we've done it well. And it's wonderful.
It was interesting as I looked through, you know, my institutional knowledge of Milwaukee and working with Milwaukee Magazine goes back 12 years. And as I looked through this article, the names that popped out, you know, I had sort of forgotten how many significant names have been associated with this magazine over the years. Who are some of the people that jumped out at you as having made, you know, key contributions to the magazine during this 35-year run?
Oh, well, you know, again, Betty Quadracci's contribution as publisher can't be overstated. Then we do a long interview with John Fennell. He was the editor-in-chief. I'm not going to remember the exact years, but he had the longest tenure.
92 to 2005.
Thank you. Thank you. And John is a very intelligent, insightful artist when it comes to putting together a magazine. So it was really great to get his reflections on it, and I know that that period of his life was very important to him. And you know, it was touching and fascinating talking with him. There's also, there's so many. Tom Bamberger, who, you know, is still out and about in Milwaukee. He was never a staffer, but he was a photographer for the magazine as a freelancer and also a writer. And we talked to him about this very funny article that he wrote and photographed back in 2000 called White Men Can't Dress. And he takes some photographs of the abysmal state of white men as they go to a Bucks game and compares them to African-American men who seem to have a great sense of style and also seem to take it into consideration that they are out in public as opposed to just watching the game maybe in their den. so it's a fun article.
When you put together an article like this, you mm-hmm. know, this is a feature that has multiple pieces
yes.
within it. Does it give you ideas for updating stories? Do you look at some of the things that were innovative journalism for, you know, the year 1993 mm-hmm. or 2001 and say, hey, this is something that we could put a 2018 spin on?
Absolutely. You know, for several years, the magazine did the most interesting people in town. We revisit some of those people in this article, but I still think that that would be a fun package to put together annually. And Mitch, you would be at the top of the list.
Oh, thanks. Oh, I'm blushing.
Don't laugh. You are. But that was really fun, too, because in the 1983 version of that story, some of the people that we put a spotlight on were just so outrageous, including John Naus, and I hope that that's how he pronounced his name, but he talked about a hyphenated profession, priest, philosophy teacher, and clown. I mean, come on. Where are they now? Where are these people these days? Where's the new John Naus?
Other stories that jumped out at you that you were exposed to maybe for the first time as this anniversary came about?
You know, when I look back on some of the investigative pieces that we've run over the years, I'm just so impressed by them. And one in particular was a story about the former mayor, John Norquist, and his affair with Marilyn Figueroa. And a lot of these stories I have to give credit to Mary Van de Kamp Knoll, who was a staff writer at the time, and she just so many of the stories that we looked at when we were putting together this article were by Mary, and she was a fantastic reporter, and they're just great stories. They were groundbreaking. There's one by Zach Brook, who still writes for us, but it was really the first thing that Zach wrote. And it was the murder of a tyrant, and it was about the murder of Carl Lotharius as he left Von Trier, the bar that he owned.
I remember this story. We had Zach on the air talking about it.
Really?
In fact, it was a gripping story.
Yeah, amazing story. And you know, those are a couple of the things that stand out. Another thing that stands out is when the Quads acquired Milwaukee Magazine. The editor at the time was a man named Frank Kuznick. And we just thought this was legend, but apparently it's true. Frank was a little upset when he left that post a few months later. And so he took a fish, a dead fish, and hid it in the ceiling. And it took, you know, weeks and weeks for people to figure out what the smell was and where it was coming from. And it's just, you know, I don't know. It sounds like such a great newsroom story. Those things just don't happen anymore. Not that I'd really want that one to happen, but you know what I'm saying.
Well, and Frank Kuznick is still out there, right?
Yes, yes. He's in Prague. So, you know, there's life after Milwaukee Magazine. And then we reprinted a couple of the ads that
I was going to ask about. These are definitely a product of their time.
Oh, they're just amazing, and it's hard to talk about them on the radio because you really have to see them to believe them. But they, as the headline says, "Stay classy, Milmag," and they really reflect that idea of class circa 1983. And one shows a Rolls Royce and a couple getting out of it, And the dialogue is, the lady says, "Did you remember the Dom Perignon?" And he says, "Yes, dear. The pâté? Yes, dear. The truffles? Yes, dear. Milwaukee Magazine? Oops." So, I don't know.
Kind of makes me squirm to look at it. Having lived through that decade.
Me too. Me too. And then we also revisit Joe Bartolotta and his partner at that time, Joe DeRosa. And, you know, Bartolotta's is also having an anniversary this year. So it's nice to look back on them.
Well, this is great stuff. And it must have been quite a bit of fun to revisit so many eras within that 35 years.
It was fun, and it was very educational for me. And it was also great to see how many of the faces that were in the magazine in the 80s and through the decades are still major players in Milwaukee and still doing great things for the city.
Well, Carol Nixon, thanks so much. Best of luck on the next 35 years.
Oh, thank you, Mitch.
Carol Nixon is editor-in-chief of Milwaukee Magazine. The magazine's 35th anniversary issue is on newsstands in January.
One last break, and then we'll catch up with our On That Note contributor when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect continues now on WUWM. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Did you have the chance to take in any live music over the holidays? Whether it is a performance of the Nutcracker or holiday pops music or a rock concert, music is an integral part of the holiday season for many of us.
Playing music was a key part of contributor Robert Cohen's season. Cohen is a professional cellist and talks about the life of a working classical musician each month with Bonnie North in a segment called On That Note.
Cohen talks about his experience late last month playing chamber music with a variety of musicians.
When you put musicians together, like in this case, I didn't really know the musicians terribly well. I'd met them briefly before. So we had Irina Botan, who's a Romanian pianist, absolutely phenomenal pianist, and Natalie Clauder, incredible violinist who was born in Scotland. And we were programmed to play Shostakovich Piano Trio No. 2, which is a phenomenal piece. I mean, it's earth-shattering, you know, enormously profound, written in 1944, all about the war and so on. And it is a great, great piece of music, which, you know, I've played so many times in my life. But what was interesting, I think, and extraordinary, was just the impact this particular performance had on me, and I think the others, and also the audience. And when you perform something and prepare something in that way, it lives on in you, I mean, probably indefinitely, you know. Somehow, you know, we had a pianist who's played the piece a few times. There's me who's played it many, many times. Violinists who played it very few times. They're a different generation to me. So their experience of the piece is different. Our cultural backgrounds are different. We had kind of very limited, what I would call very limited time to prepare it. But there was a kind of amazing excitement in rehearsals where the artistry somehow of each person was being stimulated by the other, or the others. So, you know, somebody would say they felt something about the piece of music, and that would inspire you to think, oh, yes, that's an incredible way of looking at it. So then on top of that, I can add something to it. And then the third person would bring some new vision to it. And each rehearsal was like layers, very, very quickly piling on top of each other, building a kind of new vision of the piece, pulling out all your old feelings, but somehow turning them into some new construction, if you like, and a new atmosphere. And I have to say that, you know, in the end, it was really phenomenal. It was a feeling that not only had we bonded as human beings and musicians in an incredibly short time, but then it created an enormous wave in the performance. And my wife said that there were so many people crying in the audience just because it was so powerful and so emotional. And that's, for me, and I know for the other musicians, really, really inspiring, really sort of life-enhancing experience. And of course, these things don't happen every day. And one works professionally and one tries to make music as inspiring as possible. But somehow when it clicks with the musicians, and we're three of us are so incredibly different personalities. So you'd kind of think, well, here's a great piece of music that's drawing three people together in a very short amount of time and creating the sort of impact that you always want music to create. And yeah, it leaves you with something really amazing.
Well, I was going to say magic. It's like you ended up in that perfect storm of the right people, the right piece of music, the right time, and it all worked. And it's the thing, I think, for all the musicians I talk to in this job, it's the thing that you want the most. That's why you do it.
It is, but somehow, of course, as we know, you know, wanting it and pushing
yes.
for it.
Yeah.
The chemistry somehow really has to be right. And you're right, the timing, maybe for each person, has to be just right. And the atmosphere in the hall, the sense of, you know, maybe the, even the timing of it being the last, almost the last thing before Christmas, who knows? But I just found it amazing. I mean, also, you know, you have this short amount of time to prepare it, but after the rehearsals, there are so many thoughts going on in your mind throughout the rest of the day, the evening. You come back to the next rehearsal stimulated and having thought, kind of rehearsed it in your own mind without the others, and you continue. And each person's done that, I'm sure. So it grows amazingly fast. And that's terribly exciting, you know, that when you arrive to meet again, you've already progressed so much. I think that momentum is exhilarating.
And we've talked in the past about revisiting pieces that you've played many times.
Yeah.
And in this case, you said, you know, you've played this particular trio any number of times over the years. Do you feel that you have a new understanding of it now because of this experience?
I absolutely do. I mean, you know, there was one moment when Natalie, the violinist, just needed a moment to think in the middle of the rehearsal, just silence while she was thinking about how she was going to portray a particular melody. And it didn't really matter how many she asked me, and she asked Irina, you know, what do you think about this? And what about the character and the sound and the intention of this phrase? And we made our points, and then she needed somehow silence just to assimilate that along with whatever she was searching for in her own mind. So there was this pause while she just did whatever she, in her, she's an incredibly imaginative person, imaginative musician. And somehow we knew that when she put her bow back on the string, it was going to be something extraordinary. And it was. I think that level of imagination, that level of talent and that ability to conjure something out of your own soul to portray the music is really an amazing talent. That's the sort of thing that was going on in rehearsals, conversations. Sometimes even just, I remember Irina expressing, there's a place in the music, for instance, where we play with these mutes on the instrument, which really cut the amount of sound and make the instrument sound very distant and very sort of restrained. And she's, as a pianist, she doesn't use that. It's just for the string players that we use these mutes. And she was saying, expressing it, she was saying it's like somebody trying to shout, trying to express their feelings, but their hand is so firmly over their mouth that very little gets through. There's that sense. And just the way she put it, much more beautifully than I've just done, makes you feel very different when you then play that passage.
And so I assume that the next time you play this piece, whenever that is and with whomever it is, you're going to be bringing all of what you experienced with this to the next time.
Yes, I'm sure I will. I mean, But then I'm sure if it's with different people, I'm going to hope that I'm going to have a similar experience, but it's going to be a different one because it will be with two different people.
Do you hope to play with these two musicians again?
Most definitely. I think when you've had an experience like that, you know, you're desperate, actually. I mean, I was sending the messages. We were messaging each other, you know, the day after saying, oh, I'm already missing really playing with you, you know, because there's that sense that if that's how it can be, you just want to continue.
Well, maybe there's a new trio in the making here.
Well, maybe. But maybe it's just a chance to play with people like this as often as one can and have these experiences. And I think that's what I'm really excited about in the next few years is looking for these, you know, situations where really inspiring musicians come together. And maybe, you know, we're not spending too much time together, but just having fantastic rehearsals, brilliant performances, and then saying, look forward to another time, whenever that might be.
And you are embarking on kind of a new phase of your career. 2018 marks a whole bunch of changes for you, and they sound like they're exciting changes. I mean, you have a solo tour coming up, don't you?
That's right. I finish with the Fine Arts Quartet at the end of January. I immediately go on tour in Canada, doing two brilliant recital programs, one which is really kind of classical and a kind of very typical classic cello, if you like, and with Brahms and Beethoven and so on. Another program which is much more contemporary and really, really atmospheric with Arvo Pärt and Shostakovich, actually, you know, very, very powerful, extraordinary music in a different way. And then I'm doing solo Bach, which I always love to do, including all of the complete Bach suites and
wow,
a sort of marathon event. And then I'm doing things like Brahms Double Concerto, which is one of my most favorite concertos with orchestra, with violin and cello concerto. So there are some really exciting things coming up, actually, very soon, really.
Well, we're looking forward to seeing you in the last performances here with the Fine Arts Quartet. And even though the quartet continues, you and Juan Miguel will be moving on, as you say, to other things. Are you planning to try to, at some point, swing your tours through Milwaukee again, since you won't be coming here regularly?
Well, I think that would be really lovely. I mean, after all, you know, I feel like I know the audience pretty well now, and they probably feel they know me too. So I think playing for the Milwaukee audience will always be a special thing now. And then, you know, I'm looking forward to making that happen, yes.
I hope so. And of course, we're going to keep talking.
Indeed. Yeah. Of course, Bonnie.
That's not going to end. I was going to say, you better not. you better not disappear over the horizon there, you know.
No, there's no horizon, actually.
That's true. That's true. We are on Skype. Well, I am looking forward to many more conversations with you, looking forward to hearing about all kinds of new adventures in music. Mm. And I hope at some point we will have you back in the studio to perform for us again.
Definitely. Absolutely.
All right. So we will see you at the end of the month here in Milwaukee. And then who knows? But soon.
Yes.
Soon, soon.
But soon. Yes, indeed.
All right, Robert. Thank you so much. And again, Happy New Year.
And to you, Bonnie. Thanks.
Robert Cohen is cellist for the Fine Arts Quartet and a regular Lake Effect contributor. He brings us his On That Note segment each month. This month, he joined Bonnie North from London. And that's today's edition of the show. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and I sure hope you'll join us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Stay tuned. It's 11 o'clock, and Fresh Air is next.